Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, one of our chaplains, in fact, chief of chaplain here at Honey Lake Clinic. And today we're going to be talking about the role of medication in mental health treatment. Before we get into the actual question of medication, we had a couple of questions that came in, and I want to just read those and address those questions, then we'll get into our topic for today. First question, I have a daughter that lives with me that refuses to get any treatment for her mental illness. She displays all the attributes of the spirit. She's kind, patient, and so on. But I struggle with her irritability to take care of her personal hygiene. She doesn't seem to get the importance of looking presentable. Everything seems to go well until I bring up the subject. She turns on me and brings up my flaws and actually blames me for her inability to do things. She gets really hurt. She's not always been like this. The opposite is quite the truth. She took excessive amount of showering. I tried to look the other way, but the situation has only gotten worse. What shall I do? Any advice would be appreciated. Danielle, you want to speak in this? You're smiling because I think
there's a lot in there.
Well, either one of you, what are you all hearing in this description? First off, what you ought to be hearing is lack of information. Mm-hmm. There's critical pieces of information we don't know. We don't know the age of the child. If this was a 15-year-old or is this a 35-year-old daughter, that makes a big difference.
Yes.
And we don't know. Okay, so we're going to have to be very general. Mm-hmm. There's in my mind, there's a lot of differential things going on here. Is this rebelliousness? Is this a adolescent doing marijuana and drugs, and thus they don't care anymore, and they got the, I'm just going to stay high and not take care of my hygiene anymore? It could be. Is this somebody having a psychotic break, a schizophrenic or a prodromal schizophrenia, which often looks like this as well? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say to you that we can't give any specific advice because we don't know what the underlying problem is. What you've described is there is symptomology going on here.
Yep.
Something is off and something is wrong, and you cannot ignore it. So you need to rally the resources in your community, whether that is other family members, whether that is church friends, whether that is reaching out to a healthcare clinic of some sort, but you need to rally the resources to get your daughter an actual assessment of what's going on. And then once you know what you're dealing with, then you can decide what the most appropriate action to take is.
One of the nuances I heard in that, and I hope I'm not reading this into it, was she mentioned that her daughter has all the marks of the spirit. And one of the things I think is important to differentiate is that we are three-part beings. You know, God has three parts. He made us in his image. We have three parts. And just because something happens in our spirit doesn't automatically make my body change. It can, but I might have a physical problem. I might have a mental health problem. But it may, just because I'm working to improve my spiritual life doesn't mean I don't also have mental health struggles.
Well, that is a really good point. I validate that completely. I do not find fault with that in any way. Okay, well, I'm going to say that because I'm going to take a different angle on this, but what you said is absolutely right on, so I'm supporting you totally. Mm-hmm. However, when she said that she displays all the attributes of the spirit, kind, personal hygiene, kind and patient and so on, her very next sentence is, she doesn't see, but I struggle with her irritability.
Mm-hmm.
And then she accuses me falsely of all this other stuff. That is not actually fruit of the spirit. So I would suggest that maybe there needs to be a little bit more accurate assessment of what you're dealing with. Maybe you wish and long for your daughter to have all the fruits, but maybe she actually is still struggling in her maturity and hasn't yet achieved all those fruits.
I'm with you.
Okay.
I'm with you.
All right. Second question was, my question is, why do some individuals live a reckless lifestyle yet do not reap the consequence of death as some do? For example, some people do drugs, are in gangs, and yet come out and are converted and continue to live out this human life, this earthly life, and others don't. So nobody lives reckless lifestyles without consequence.
Mm-hmm.
That is a misunderstanding of objective reality. You may not know the consequence. You may not see the consequence. I can tell you there are consequences. There are consequences on character. There are consequences on loss opportunity. There's consequence on searing conscience, hardening heart. It, can God heal and forgive? Yes. But that doesn't mean wounds weren't inflicted to self and others. There are broken relationships. There's a loss of maturing process. So you've delayed your actual, you might start maturing later, but now you're a decade behind and where you could have been in your life development. There's consequence. They've actually done studies on individuals comparing people who live hedonistic lives, that's this self-indulgent, drug, pleasure-seeking life, from people who live altruistic lives of service in their community. Yeah. And they had them self-rate themselves on how their emotional state of well-happiness is, and they scored the same on their self-rating.
Wow.
And then they took blood samples and looked at epigenetic modification of their DNA in immune cells, and they had significant differences as a group, not two people, but the groups of people. Those who lived altruistic and lives of service had upregulation of the genes that helped you fight infections, and downregulation of genes that caused inflammation, and that accelerates aging. So they would age lower, live longer on the earth, and have less sickness. Wow. Whereas the hedonistic people who emotionally said they were happy actually had upregulation of the inflammatory genes and downregulation of the viral fighting genes, which would make them age sooner and they'll die younger.
Wow.
And there's also the, which is incredibly huge on that component, but I've never met a person who is living in a lifestyle that is counter to God's best that has true peace.
That's right.
You know,
they might say it, but.
Well, they may feel good, but it's that constant chasing that ends up happening, so, and you never have true peace.
So the reason questions like this come is because the questioner, and David asked some of these questions in the Psalms, and so this doesn't make you a bad person to actually ask this question, but but we all are vulnerable to focus on the wrong things. Mm-hmm. And the questions come when we focus on, but it seems like the wicked get wealthy and get powerful and get successful and get mansions, and the righteous end up being taken advantage of and end up poor and homeless, and Jesus had not a pillow to lay his head. And there is some truth in this world that the wicked will abuse the righteous. There's truth in that. But that doesn't mean they get away with it or have a better outcome, because the righteous get eternal life and the wicked get eternal death. So I would tell you to reframe the question, try to see it more from the landscape of design law and how reality works, and then I don't think you'll have this concern anymore that nobody gets away with it.
Yep.
All right, so our question, the role of medication in mental health treatment. Guys, I got lots to say, but what are you hearing? What are the questions you're hearing? What are the things we want to talk about?
One of the things I'd love to dive into is, you know, from the spiritual side of the house, you know, a lot of Christians will come to me and say, is it okay for me to take medications for a variety of reasons? Like sometimes people come to me and say, hey, I was on a substance for a long time and that messed my life up. That brought so much harm into my life. How is this medication going to bring me healing? And the other component that goes with that is it actually okay for Christians to take medication to assist their health, especially their, you know, specifically their mental health?
So right use of medication is something that actually is treating a specific disorder, disease, cause, series of symptoms that will improve one's function and health over time. I mean, that is the goal.
Right.
And so our my general view that our responsibility in this world today is to love the Lord our God with our heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's our first order. Second order is neighbor as self. First order then means we have responsibility to present ourselves to God in the best condition for the greatest usefulness possible. If we have a health condition that interferes with our ability to fulfill God's calling and purpose in our life, to the degree we have the resources available to treat and remedy that condition, we have a responsibility to do that. Now, that could be, for instance, there are certain forms of high blood pressure and diabetes that with healthy lifestyle, you can address it best by living a healthy lifestyle, losing weight, exercising, etc. There are other forms of the disorder for other reasons that the only way to address it would be with certain medication. And if you don't, you're going to end up with strokes and heart attacks and become an invalid and maybe even die and not be able to fulfill God's purpose. Yeah. So the principle is, if I'm using medication, it needs to be improving my function for the Lord and helping me be the healthiest version of me possible. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So that's how I would say that. And then in each circumstance, it's different. There are individuals who have had addictions where medications can actually reduce their likelihood of relapse and keep them in a sober state to allow them to build habit paths of healthy functioning and coping and dealing with life stressors without turning to substances to self-medicate or escapism through. Yes. And so medication that can help them stay sober would be a very wise choice to make. Now, the problem is not necessarily that they don't want to be healthy, but they actually don't want to be honest with themselves. They want to believe that they can do it without medication, that they're stronger than they are, that their resolve will carry the day. And typically with addictions, that's just not true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you know, ends up being a huge thing to recognize that, you know, we just because we're in Christ doesn't mean we don't need help. It doesn't mean we can do it all on our own now.
So should we talk about what medications can do and what they can't do?
Sure.
I think that'd be really valuable because there's a lot of misunderstanding on what medication even is. Yeah.
So medications cannot cause somebody who believes in Buddha to believe in Jesus or vice versa. It can't.
Yeah.
Medications cannot cause somebody to fall in love or fall out of love. Medications, in other words, cannot change a person's beliefs or values. They can't do that.
Yeah.
Medications can change the efficiency of your processor. So a person who is in a state of depression and can't focus and think, a medication could help them think and focus better. But if their pattern of thinking before they went into depression was, I'm no good, I suck, I'm bad, nobody likes me, I can't do anything right, and then we turn their processor back on and they'll start thinking those same thoughts again. It won't change those thoughts. Yep. I can't give somebody a medication, for instance, that will cause them to start speaking a new language.
Right.
Medication can't do that. I can, however, slow down their processor. So if somebody has a processor that's running full steam, out of control, I'm no good, I'm worrying about it, fret, and they're always in the frantic, I can give them medication that just slows that whole system down. Mm-hmm. Slows it down. And that can, for some people, give them a space where they can actually then start thinking and learning a new way to assess and understand reality. But it's the new way of assessing, understand reality, processing, and coping that actually will be long-term healing for them. But the medication can't heal that. There are some disorders where the medications, our classic would be attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It is due to some type of dopamine, the majority, not all, but the majority, dopamine signaling issues in the prefrontal cortex. And if you don't have enough dopamine, then you can't attend, you can't focus. And there's genetic anomalies in the human genome where some people actually have a gene defect where they actually don't have enough dopamine in the prefrontal cortex.
Yep.
The medications simply increase dopamine in the prefrontal cortex and they can focus and pay attention better. And I want to say for the listeners going, no, it's food coloring, it's food allergy, and okay. Anything that impairs prefrontal cortex function, anything that impairs it, will create symptoms that look like ADHD. If somebody gets intoxicated with alcohol, while they're intoxicated, they will not attend and focus well. They'll be more distractible. They'll be more impulsive because prefrontal cortex is impaired. If somebody has a prefrontal cortex injury, like a stroke or a bad concussion, they will have the same symptomology. If somebody has Alzheimer's dementia, as they dement, they lose all those prefrontal cortex abilities, etc. Prefrontal cortex dysfunction. Now, there are mimickers. If somebody is actually severely sleep deprived, your prefrontal cortex is impaired and you will look like a distractible ADHD person if you're severely sleep deprived.
Yep.
Okay? And so I say this to those who are hearing because there have been some documentation of individual cases who somebody had a food allergy and you got rid of the food allergy and their attention improved. They didn't have ADHD.
Yes.
They had a food allergy with the symptoms of distractibility and impaired prefrontal cortex function. Oh, sleep apnea is another one. Looks like that because you're actually in and out of light stage sleep and not oxygenating your brain well at night. Mm-hmm. And you can look like ADHD and you treat that. It goes away. That wasn't ADHD. And so there are mimickers of ADHD out there. And I say that because I don't want people to say, oh, you're just pushing meds. I'm not pushing meds. I want people to get the treatment that restores them best.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Other things that you've heard that people want to know about medication, the role of medication in mental health treatment. Can medication give somebody a new character?
No.
If they're a liar, cheat, fraud, mm-hmm. it can't. Yeah. So when we talk about salvation, can somebody have a loving, trust relationship with Jesus Christ with good character and suffer from a mental illness like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or major depression? Can they do that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And then medication can work to help restore neurobiological functioning, mm-hmm. but it will not change. And that will then make them more useful in God's cause because they're not, you know, impaired in their functioning by whatever mental health disorder they're struggling with. That's right, the purpose right. of medication.
And one of the things that we see as a struggle in certain areas of the faith where they take passages like in 1 Peter, who's quoting Isaiah, that by his stripes we were healed. And they'll say, see, you've already got the healing through Jesus, so you shouldn't go to a psychiatrist or a therapist or a doctor for your healing. If you have enough faith, then you should do it. And by taking the medication, you're actually not living with enough faith. You're actually compromising your faith.
Yeah, and
really
you know
glad
what
you brought that up.
Yeah, and what they have just done is they've mixed what you already differentiated earlier, when you differentiated the tripartite nature of our being. They're mixing that up. The faith element that we live by is primarily for our renewal of our spirit and souls, which is our character development with new motives to love God and love others, the mm-hmm. spirit to love God and love others, and then we develop character of honesty, loyalty, faithfulness, and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. We are not actually promised, and I have to tell my patients this, and you, if I'm wrong, you show me a Bible verse that tells me I'm wrong. But what I understand, God does not promise us new biology, new physiology, until the second coming when yep. the mortal puts on immortality and the corruption puts on corruption.
That's right. Yes.
We get new hearts and right spirits now. So we get new character and the new motivating energy of love to God, and the love of God compels us. But that happens in a mortal physiology that is still subject to decay and disease and death. Mm-hmm. And to the degree we're suffering from physical health problems with a reborn spirit, mm-hmm. we have the responsibility to do all in our power to live a healthy lifestyle, and that would include in certain disease states, taking the medications that treat those disease states. It was wiser, and I want to be very clear, because there's this fraudulent thing in the landscape of just healthcare in America today, not exclusive to mental health care. But there's this idea that you can live any way you want, don't exercise, eat junk food and fast food. And then when you get obese and get diabetic and get hypertensive, just go to your doctor and take medicine and you can be healthy. This is a lie. That is mm-hmm. not what I'm saying that you should be doing. I'm saying that your first responsibility is to the best of your ability live in harmony with the laws of health.
Yep.
Eat reasonably, sleep reasonably, exercise, eat good foods, and all these types of things. Rest with the Lord each week, all the things we need to do. But even doing all that, physiologically, health problems can happen. And some of those happen to our brain. And when that happens, then getting on medications, if there are no other treatable things that you prefer that will work, the goal is highest level of functioning. Mm-hmm. But some people want to go this way because they have this fear that taking a medication somehow means they don't have faith. Mm-hmm. And this is a lie.
Another lie that I've heard is people are afraid medication will change them for the worse, maybe change their personality, change their functioning and a worse way. I've actually heard that quite a bit.
I've seen that with patients yeah. who in their bipolarness, they like their mania. They actually like that part, and they're afraid if they take the medication that they won't be. They'll just be like a zombie.
Well, yeah, and people tend to reference stories where they've seen somebody who maybe had ADHD or bipolar, took a medication, and they use the term zombie.
Okay, so there are some elements here. Medication will not change character.
Yes. Good.
Medication can change ability. For instance, a medication can make one more sleepy as a side effect. Medication, for some people, depending on the medication, can reduce creativity, depending on the medication.
Yep.
Some very creative artists and musicians don't want to go on medication because it impairs their creativity, their spontaneity. Some who are actually sick in mania like the euphoric high and don't want to actually just be in a normal mood, and so they won't take medication. But that is not impairment. That is actually they prefer the pathology to the wellness. But on the other side of it, sometimes medication, it's not changing their personality per se. It's undermining some of the spark of spontaneity or creativity. That can happen. If it happens, there needs to be a conversation with the prescriber to look for alternative treatments to help them treat whatever the disorder is without interfering with those elements of function.
Yep. So, Dr. Jennings, what do you say to people who are worried about becoming dependent on their medication?
So I guess that means what they mean by dependent. Dependent mean, does a diabetic who needs insulin, do they depend on their insulin?
That's good.
I have family members who have hypothyroidism, and they have to take a thyroid medicine every day. They depend on their thyroid medicine.
But it's so not this the idea, medicine that made them dependent. They were dependent already before they ever.
So the question is, are they treating a condition that without the somebody with hypertension that is not resolved by lifestyle factors, and if they don't take their hypertension medicine, their blood pressure goes up. They're dependent on their hypertension medicine. So this idea of dependence on medicine, it really, the question is, can you be healthy and maximize your functioning for the Lord without the medicine? Or will whatever the underlying physiological condition is that's being treated with the medicine recur and you become debilitated and less functional? Is that a weakness, or does that mean you have a chronic condition in a physiological body that is not as God designed it needing, and we are compensating through this treatment to maximize your function? So some people are dependent on their medicine for physiological functioning, whether it's hypothyroidism, diabetes, hypertension, or certain mental health conditions. Now, if we're talking about addictive dependence, now there's an addictive dependence, well, you can actually become physiologically tolerant. So a person with a chronic pain state gets put on opioids and the body adapts to that and they up the dose of it and they stop their opioids, they go to the withdrawal. That is not addiction. That's physiologic dependence, that the body becomes clinically dependent upon that medicine. Addiction, though, is a maladaptive pattern of craving and pursuit of and compulsive use of medicine outside of simply maximizing one's function as prescribed by your doctor.
Yep. Would you say that's connected to where Jesus said it's not what goes in our body that makes us unclean, but what comes out of our heart? Like it's the heart behind why they're taking the medication?
Certainly. Or the substance? Yeah. So I think so. That's how I would answer that. And so then I would have to also ask them, tell me what you mean when you say dependent upon. Yeah. I think they have some fear in their mind that it means that they're somehow weak in some way. And then it's probably they're still in denial of their condition. A diabetic doesn't really feel weak if they need insulin. They've accepted they got diabetes. They need the insulin. And so most of the time, our psych patients are still in denial that they have a physiological condition, and that they're treating because of the fallen state in which our physiology is functioning in, and they believe that somehow they're a weak human being because they need a medicine to help them deal with that condition.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Absolutely.
There's another one, though. You know, miracle. Some people want a medicine, and they want to take the medicine as a magic fix. I'll take my medicine. And the people who do this are primarily people who don't have the biological need for the medicine. These are the people who have unresolved trauma issues, or they have personality disordered issues. They have unresolved, perhaps spiritual issues of guilt and shame, and they don't want to look inward and deal with the real cause of their dysfunction, their you know, unresolved trauma, their guilt, their shame. They don't want to actually face that and work it through, and so they long for something to numb their inner world, so they don't feel the pain anymore. And this is a driver in a lot of addictions. People will medicate themselves with stuff, but oftentimes people will look for prescription meds to help them not feel the anxiety or the restlessness or the uneasiness that is coming from a person who's actually not at peace with themselves on the inside.
Yep.
And medicine can't fix that. Medicine can numb people. It can't fix the cause in that circumstance. And people, I've seen this in modern psychiatry because our modern landscape of healthcare practice in this country has, and it's been driven by third-party payer systems, what we call insurances, have financially incentivized psychiatrists to not talk to their patients and do psychotherapy, but to be primarily prescribers. Psychiatrists are taking third-party, and they're not, if they're cash only and don't take insurances, then they're under less pressure. But if they're in an insurance panel, they will be financially incentivized, make more money if they do 10 to 15 minute med check appointments and just prescribe meds and actually don't take the time to talk through the issues with their patient. That's the reality of the landscape of psychiatry. And therefore, when patients have symptoms of anxiety or mood disturbance, they will get on a medication. And if the cause of that is not originating in their brain is reacting to something, a dysfunctional relationship, unresolved spiritual issues, unresolved trauma issues. Their brain is reacting to that, and that's what the true cause is. They won't get well with the medication. They might have transient symptom relief, but then they get worse, and then they start piling on the meds. They add another med and another med and another med, and I've seen patients on 4, 6, sometimes 7 psychiatric medicines, and they're barely functioning. Why? Yeah. Because their primary dysfunction is not originating in the brain part, the three parts, okay? It's originating in some other aspect of their being that is being ignored.
Mm. Yeah, and this really encourages pain avoidance, where we equate pain means something's wrong, and if I'm not in pain, it means something's right. So people seek as quickly as possible to alleviate pain because they equate that with health, when a lot of the times healing is actually quite painful, especially therapeutically. You're facing things that bring up a lot of, not discomfort, but genuine pain and grief. But that's part of what healing looks like.
In fact, you know, one of my sayings, once there is brokenness,
there's no pain-free options.
There's no pain-free options. Yeah. And so if somebody has wounds in their heart and mind, their only choice is to engage a process that brings genuine healing or not.
Yep.
They do not have a choice to avoid pain. Mm-hmm. And those people who take multiple meds to numb their emotional pain, they're not actually avoiding pain. They are numbing it, but they're not avoiding it. And I've never met people that have done this that aren't in a chronic state of emotional misery while they're numbed on their meds. And typically in social difficulties as well. They don't navigate relationships well. They don't fulfill life's duties as well. And so they have a chronic state of pain while they're trying to avoid the transient increased pain that comes from dealing with a problem. And that's true with physical health as well. You have to debride a wound and get the dirt and gravel out of it. It hurts to do that. If you don't do it, though, the moment-to-moment pain might be less because you're not digging into a wound. But the chronic pain, and then it spreads to the whole system and you get infected and everything gets worse over time. Yeah. That's a great metaphor for people with emotional pain. And you're right. There are a lot of people in our country that are on meds that help them avoid pain and keep them going through the motions of life, but they do not have the full, rich, thriving life that Christ would have them have because there are problems, emotional, spiritual, that are being ignored, and they're medicating the symptom so that they can, avoid dealing with the problem.
Yep. And so people have to understand which aspect of their life is infected because there are things that just therapy can't accomplish.
Right. That's right.
But there's also things that just medication can't accomplish.
That's right.
And there's also things that neither can accomplish.
Right. If somebody has schizophrenia and they have hallucinations and delusions and disorganized thought, a good psychotherapist is not going to resolve that. That's a physiological problem originating in the brain, and they need some intervention to stabilize the brain for those symptoms to go away. Mm-hmm. But conversely, somebody who has significant anxiety, I will tell you, anxiety is almost always a symptom of some other problem. Not a problem, not an actual, even though in the DSM we've given diagnostic labels to various anxiety disorders, that's not really true in how reality works. Anxiety serves to the mind like pain does to the body. It both alerts you something is wrong and simultaneously motivates you to do something. Mm. Yep. That's what pain does to your body. Something's wrong, do something. Right. And the worse the pain, the more motivated you are. The worse the anxiety, the more motivated you are. That's its purpose. But many people have come to believe that the anxiety symptom is the problem, and then they simply seek some medication, alcohol, drugs, or prescriptions to make the anxiety go away without ever seeking the cause of the anxiety. And that's what we do here at Honey Lake. We help people go past the symptom to resolve the underlying reason for the symptom.
Yep. And I want to say I've had so many people tell me that they can't do something because of my anxiety. And they have been told by somebody at some point that anxiety is chronic, it's incurable, and they have to live with it. And one of the first conversations we have is looking into where the anxiety is coming from. And I've never seen a situation where it's just anxiety with no cause.
You're exactly right. It always has a cause. Sometimes that cause is something that the patient has done. Often it's something that's been done to the patient.
Yep.
Sometimes it's physiological. Severe hyperthyroidism will cause panic and anxiety and racing heart. Mm-hmm. And that's a but the anxiety is not the problem. It's a symptom of the hyperthyroid.
Yeah.
And so again, I want our listeners to understand that if you're having a lot of anxiety symptoms, you should be asking, what is the cause of the symptom? If you had pain, you wouldn't go, well, I have a pain disorder. You go, what's wrong?
Yeah.
Same thing. And if you don't know, get a professional to help you. But I will tell you, when you today in the landscape of modern mental health, you go to see a professional, they have been conditioned to just look at your symptoms and then diagnose your symptoms as a disorder. Many mental health professionals don't even think about, why are you having this? What's the cause?
Yeah.
Well, you've got an anxiety disorder. Here, take a medicine. Yeah. And they're part of the problem in actually helping people get well. It's really, really not a healthy way to think about it.
Absolutely.
Switching back to the spiritual side of the house as clinicians, what do you guys do? Because I've come into this situation a few times when a person gets a diagnosis, they finally, for maybe the first time in their life, actually know what's going on inside of them. And it's long term. And they're going to have to take medication to treat their mental health for long periods of time, possibly the rest of their life. And they ask the question, why would God make me this way? Why is God punishing me with this when other people don't have it? Why do I have this now for the rest of my life or for this long period of time?
So the question is the question communicates a falsehood.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lie that they've been told somewhere. They have a belief that God had a direct hand in their individual life.
Yep.
The Bible doesn't teach that anyway. It's a common belief, but it's not biblical. Mm-hmm. God had a direct hand in creating Adam and Eden, and he was sinless. Creating Eve in Eden, and she was sinless, in the incarnation of Jesus Christ, and he was sinless. But God gave Adam and Eve, at their creation, the ability to procreate, to make beings in their image.
Yep.
And he gave them freedom with that gift. So every human being since Adam and Eve, other than Jesus, God did not have a direct personal hand in their creation.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
This is the outworking of an ability God gave the species human to carry out. So, for instance, when a man rapes a woman and she becomes pregnant, this is not an act of God.
Mm-hmm.
It is the act of a sinful man abusing an ability God gave him.
Mm. That's important, yeah.
When a woman gets pregnant and she drinks a bottle of vodka every day and the baby is born with fetal alcohol syndrome, that was not God knitting together the baby in the womb that way.
Yeah.
That was a woman abusing an ability God gave her.
Mm.
And so the answer is, God didn't make you this way. The Bible tells us in Romans chapter 8, all nature groans under the weight of sin. And Psalms 51:5 tells us we're born in sin, conceived in iniquity. We are here the way we are. And if people go, well, I wished I'd had a different mother and a different father because both my parents had alcoholism and I have alcoholism, or both my parents were schizophrenic and I'm schizophrenic. There's another reality. I have actually two siblings, one brother and a sister from the same parents. Same biologic parents, brother and sister. They are not me. If my mother and father would have impregnated my mother on any other month of my mother's cycles in her entire life, it would not be me.
Hmm.
The only way me, the individual that I am, exist is if my, and if my mother would have gotten impregnated by any other man than my father, it wouldn't be me. Now, my mother would still have a child. It wouldn't be me. It'd be some other child, like my brother or sister, but they're not me. The only way the individual in your office exists is the very two specific people got together and had a child at a particular time of that woman's cycles. For that individual, if they, so if you say, I wish I had a different father, well, your mother could have had a child with a different man, but you could not exist. And so you were born in this world because God gave humans the ability to procreate, and you do have problems, but God's grace can bring glory out of your life. Who sinned that this man was born blind, him or his parents? Neither. This was permitted for the glory of God to be manifest in his life.
Great connection.
Okay. Yeah. Most people do not understand this. And thus they put this back on God, that God did this to me. And thus they distrust God and they have a lot of fear. Now, chaplain, as I say this, as a chaplain, Bible scholar, do you feel I said anything that contradicts Scripture?
Not at all. Not at all. It actually gives a lot of clarity, because a lot of times people will take that passage where, you know, I knit you together and or you knit me together in my mother's womb to be like God actually doing the weaving, rather than letting that be poetic to say, yes, you know, God is the author of life, but he's not the one that actually is putting my genetics together in my mother's womb. He's created the process, and over time.
Is that Psalms 137?
That sounds right.
Because, you know, I did a paraphrase of the Bible.
Right.
Was that 137 or, no, 139? It's 139, isn't it?
Yeah. It's 139.
It's 139.
I do neighborhoods, not addresses.
So I want to share with you. And maybe we should read it out of like the NIV, and let's examine that passage, okay? 139, and do you know the verse?
I can look it up.
I've got it right here. Okay. My glasses on where I can read this. Okay.
Your microphone.
Yeah, so let me get up here where I can read this. Let's see. Yeah, so this starts in verse 13. This is the NIV. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you, and I was made in the secret place when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in the books before they came to be. Okay. Here's what it says in the remedy, and then I'm going to explain the remedy to you, okay? For you have redeemed my heart and mind. You covered me with grace from the moment I was conceived in my mother's womb. I praise you because you are awesome. Wonderful and marvelous are your works, and I know this very well. You know my entire being, how I was built from your secret code, constructed from the elements of the earth. You saw me before I was born. My entire life was recorded in your book of foreknowledge before one day came to be. Okay, and so then I explain, because that's so variant from what is there, this is what I explain in the footnote. The Hebrew word translated in many versions as formed or made, quana, and according to the Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek lexicon dictionaries, translated most commonly as bought, by, purchased, and redeemed.
Wow.
The Hebrew word translated as inmost being, kilia, and means seat of emotions and infections. So it means redeemed my seat of emotions or infections, thus translated heart and mind. The Hebrew word translated knit me together, according to the Enhanced Strong's Lexicon, is sawkak, and translated as cover, covering, defense, and defendest, and hedge in. Contrary to popular translations, the context of this verse is not about physiological, embryological development, or God using power to physically create a newborn human life, but it's about the plan of redemption. The psalmist in Psalms 51:5 describes that he was born in sin, conceived in iniquity, and here he acknowledged that despite his sinful origins, God was already there acting to redeem him and cleanse him from sin. That's what this is really about.
And that's
what do you think about that? Do you think I'm right or wrong?
Well, I think that's the you're doing what we should be learning how to do in you know our Christian communities is how do we go back to the original language? You know, because translation is a multi-layered task, and a lot of times we take passages not just out of, you know, we learn better as we get more manuscripts, what's the appropriate terminology to use that we no longer use, but also the genre. I mean, David is writing Psalms. Those are song lyrics. It's poetry, which has a different set of rules. But what you've done by going back to the original language is you know, I hate to say decoding because you used that earlier, but it's that idea of I'm looking at what does the original word give in context and apply it to the natural world in balance.
And
with
what
the
do you think about
world.
The context? I suggest that the context is not about embryologic development. The context is about salvation from sin. That's the gospel message. That's the Bible message. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's God's plan to save from sin. And he's already acknowledged that we're born in sin, conceived in iniquity. And here he's describing God's grace is already there working to save us before we're even born.
Right.
Yep.
Do you think that is an inappropriate conclusion based on both the language and the context, or is that more likely the right conclusion? Okay. And this idea that God was knitting, and I get this from people all the time, God knit me together, and they take that literally physiologically, therefore he wanted me to have this condition. Mm-hmm. I've read Christian books with about describing your body if you have some defect in your body. Well, God knit you together that way, and he wants you to have that defect.
Oh.
Yeah, which makes God the author of the struggle rather than
and I find that quite offensive, actually, and wrong. And so this is why but I think it's shocking to a lot of people because they're so conditioned in Christianity to think because God's sovereign, he's in control. Yes, God knits us together through his original design, the code he wrote into the genome that allows for this to happen. And the design laws that he sustains that are the laws of health that allow all this to work. So he's sustaining all of that. But he's not the action arm that decides my dad and mom to get married and have kids. That was them deciding that.
And that harmonizes the passage you referred to earlier of the man that was born blind. Jesus is saying, no, this wasn't, you know, God didn't do this to punish him. You know, you're putting it back into context.
So weaving this back to the patient, the mental health patient has a mental health disorder, then this doesn't give them, well, God wanted me to have it, so I need to suffer.
Yeah.
No, God didn't want you to have it, and he wants you to get the treatment.
Right.
Yeah, God's hand is not creating brokenness. God's hand is redeeming brokenness.
So go ahead.
Yeah. And so this ties back to what we were talking about earlier, where our primary responsibility is to do what we can, what we have access to engage in restoration. And if what God's giving us access to is medication that aids in our restoration to be able to serve him better, then it's kind of an obligation to participate in that.
I agree with you completely. And I just want to mention that medications, in my view, are used when other interventions are not able to bring healing. To the degree somebody has depression because they have nutritional deficiencies, I would rather treat their nutritional deficiencies if that resolves the depression and they get well, then put them on a medication. If somebody has depression because they have untreated sleep apnea, we treat the sleep apnea. Hypothyroidism, we treat the thyroid. So medication is not a panacea. In fact, the data shows that with people with depression, for instance, medication will get about 30% of the people well if that's all you do. But if you do all the other things, we can actually get almost everybody into a depression-free state. If you do all the other lifestyle things, look at their psychologically, spiritually, physiologically, and so forth. And then there are some medication-free treatments as well that can help people with certain mental health disorders like the transcranial magnetic stimulation and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you made that distinction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, anything else you guys want to add on this topic?
I've got one more. I know I keep going back to the Bible and spirituality, but there's we've talked about this before. There's this contention from a passage in the book of Revelation that talks about, you know, Babylon and its destruction. And one of the struggles that's bringing the judgment on Babylon is the sorcery that they're practicing. And the root word there is pharmakoa. And so people will take that passage and say, see, God is against pharmacological treatment because that's what is one of the sins of Babylon that God's judging. And I know we've talked about that before. So if we're talking about medicine and mental health in our faith, how do we treat that?
So
how do we work with that passage?
So I'm going to reference Common Reason Ministries. I'm going to answer the question. Mm-hmm. But if you're watching, go to Common Reason Ministries and type in the search engine, sorcerers. I have a blog that I've just written. It came out last week, a modern-day sorcerers. Mm-hmm. And I actually start with this passage of Revelation where the word translated sorcerer is the word pharmakeia, where we get pharmacy or pharmaceutical, and many people do what you think and think it's talking about medicine. It's not. What the Bible is talking about there is the classic witch's brew. And the witch's brew was some type of a concoction made by the shaman, the witch doctor, the witch, to cause a hallucinogenic state, a dissociative state, some altered mental state for the purpose of making the mind more suggestible to the control of the shaman.
Kind of like the oracle at Delphi.
Okay, that's the purpose. And so true sorcerers are not using primarily chemicals. They're casting spells over minds. Mm-hmm. And it's about mind control. Mm-hmm. And in our society today, the sorcerers are using various forms of media propaganda and other things to pass mind control over people. And I go through that on the blog. But in the classic history, in the Bible times, the witch's brew was a classic thing that would induce a suggestible and a dissociative hallucinogenic state that made them feel like they had something, you know, supernatural happen and make them more suggestible to bring their minds under the persuasion of the lie.
Which is obviously not pointing towards us using medication to treat mental health.
Correct.
And
exactly.
I want to bring that back to one of the main points of this podcast, which is to encourage people to challenge what they've been taught, ask questions, and learn how to think for themselves. And so what I'm hearing in that belief is that somebody really hasn't looked into much of that on their own at all.
Well, one of the things that sadly we have become conditioned to, I mean, one of the most recent studies on the two most recent generations is that over 90% of them have never read the Bible for themselves. They've only received what other people have told them about it. And that makes them very suggestible to whatever the pastor, priest, minister, writer says, rather than, like you said, asking the questions and doing your own homework.
And this is one of the problems we see in the landscape of our society. But the churches are complicit in this.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are two ways of trying to understand what's true. One is understanding how reality works, the design laws of God, the laws of mathematics, for instance. And be able to problem solve and come to your own conclusion. That's what God calls mature people to do, develop by practice the ability to discern right from wrong, Hebrews 5:14. The other way is to rely on an authority to tell you the answer. Somebody in a position who studied it have then told you what the answer is, and Christianity historically has practiced that method on their parishioners. The priest has said, the pope has said, the pastor has said, somebody has said, and then we believe because the person in authority has said. And that's what's happening in society today. Pundits and people in authority, you know, the CDC director has said, and therefore we believe because the authority has said. This is not how God runs his universe. God runs his universe by, he says in Isaiah 1, come let us reason together, though your sins are like scarlet, though they be white like snow. And he presents truth and love and wants us to comprehend and become understanding friends of him because all truth leads back to him. So I appreciate you both bringing this up. And this is what we want for our listening audience. We want them to develop these critical reasoning skills, identify the testable laws of God, and then problem solve for themselves and not rely on another authority. We are not here to do your thinking for you. If you're watching us online, we are not here to do your thinking for you. We want to present concepts, ideas, truths, principles, but we want you to begin exercising your own mind, weighing the issues for yourself, asking the questions, thinking for yourself, and then searching for testable, provable answers that are reliable. Well, thank you for joining us today on the program. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you have questions you'd like to send in and have us answer it sometime in the future, send them to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.